This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
For the Hidden Killers Podcast, I'm Stacey Cole. Donna Adelson was in court for her motions hearing. She is facing charges in a murder-for-hire plot that led to the death of her former son-in-law, Dan Markle. She's making some key legal moves just weeks before her trial is set to begin. Let's go now to the motions hearing.
Still photography, yes. Still camera. Let's turn to the other matter scheduled for this morning. Case number 2023-CF-3226, State versus Donna Adelson. All counsel of record may make their appearances.
Georgia Kappelman for the state, Your Honor.
Sarah Kelly for the state.
Andrew
Rashbaum
on behalf of Mrs. Adelson.
Alice Moore, on behalf of Mrs. Adelson. Oh, before I get off, Lamb and McNair, Ms. Dugan, I neglected to ask you if you have anything to add on behalf of the state. Bailiffs, if you please, could get back to defense counsel. Do you have anything to add, Ms. Dugan?
No,
sir. Very well. We'll continue with Ms. Adelson at this time. I want to go through all the motions that we are. Oh, let me turn on the Zoom as well before we get rolling.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Kappelman, Ms. Dugan, how many individuals were you expecting to join via Zoom this morning?
I was thinking at least three, Your Honor. Do you see?
All right, I see.
And Shelley Markell.
I see Zoom entries for Ruth Markell, Phil Markell, and I believe some other interested parties or onlookers. Beyond that, I will keep an eye on anyone who is attempting to enter. I do see one now for Shelley Markell as well.
Thank you, Judge.
For everyone who will be listening via Zoom this morning, you are not to interfere with the proceeding. However, you may listen to the argument of the attorneys and also the court proceedings as they unfold. Again, please do not interfere in any way with the proceedings. Mr. Rashbaum, does the defense have anyone that you anticipate joining via Zoom this morning?
No, Your Honor.
Very well. To go through the motions that we're going to hear today, we're going to address the state's motion in limine, the defendant's motion to use a jury questionnaire, the defendant's motion to suppress wiretap interceptions, the defendant's motion to dismiss the indictment for pre-indictment delay or to exclude evidence, the motion to hold the trial in courtroom 3B, and also the defendant's motion in limine. I believe the defense has also filed an additional motion in limine. Mr. Morris, if you can explain as to that as well.
Judge, we didn't first anticipate the court taking that issue up today because we think the court's going to need information.
information and we had as well. But
the motion was filed based on the receipt after the deadline, the discovery deadline, if you will, or in Mr. Corbett's presentation, which is 300 and something odd pages. Mr. Aschbaum, there was some back and forth in terms of when we would get it and that sort of thing. We needed it before Sergeant Corbett's deposition, which was taken with...
Talking to a microphone.
Yes, sir.
Standing order of the day. Everyone who speaks, speak into a microphone.
His deposition, Sergeant Corbett's deposition, was taken in the midst of last week, and so the motion was filed immediately on the heels of that once we learned the information that was associated with his testimony and the presentation.
Very well. As to that motion, I have not had an adequate opportunity to review it. I assume the state needs some time to prepare this as well.
I'm happy for it to be heard whenever it's convenient for the court judge.
So we can stay on our existing timeline of meeting the jury selection on the 17th. For now, let's tentatively schedule this for September 6th. Please consult with Lynn as to a particular time and courtroom. If I'm going to need additional time before we get to the 6th, I'll let you all know. Right? And also the other motion that we will hear today is the defendant's motion to preclude travel as consciousness of guilt.
Judge, for the motion that was filed this week by the defense, I did go ahead and put that draft of the presentation that they received on a flash track for you, 329 page one. I have sent one or two things since then, I believe, to the defense, and I guess they'll just let us know if they have an issue with that.
One other matter that I wanted to address as well before we get into the argument of the motions. Mrs. Adelson, previously I have addressed with you the fact that you are waiving any conflicts as it would relate to the representation of Mr. Rauschbaum. Based on where we stand procedurally at this point, when you first gave this waiver, that was prior to there being any deadlines concerning discovery or being able to view the evidence that the state plans to present at trial. Now that there has been an opportunity by you to review this discovery with your counsel, I believe it is prudent to go through these factors again, ultimately to confirm that you still wish for Mr. Rauschbaum to act as counsel. If you please can stand and raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're going to give will be the truth?
Yes.
You can lower your hand. Mrs. Adelson, you understand that you have, under the Constitution, a right to conflict-free representation. Do you understand this, ma'am? Do you also understand as well that one of your attorneys, Mr. Rauschbaum, previously represented your son in a case or a similar case in this matter?
Yes.
Do you understand that he has a duty to hold in confidence certain aspects of that representation?
I understand that.
Do you understand as well that this could create a potential or actual conflict as it relates to your representation in this trial?
Yes.
As to that conflict, do you realize, or I should say, do you understand that this could affect your defense in some way?
Yes.
Have you had an ability to consult with other counsel as to whether you wish to have a conflict-free counsel?
I'm aware of that, yes.
And as to any potential or actual conflict that may exist with Mr. Rauschbaum's representation, are you waiving this?
Yes.
Thank you. You may be seated. And again, so it's clear why I'm doing this, ma'am, at this stage, as we move closer to trial, things are going to occur rapidly, including rulings on the motions that you file, rulings on the state's motion, how this is going to affect the evidence, and how this will ultimately affect your trial. At any point, if you decide that you are no longer willing to waive this conflict concerning the representation, that is something that I'm going to need to address. Do you understand this?
I do.
If defense counsel as well becomes aware before the next hearing that the conflict is no longer waived, please bring this to the court's attention.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Let's go ahead and start with the motion that procedurally bears on whether the case will move forward or not. The defendant's motion to dismiss the indictment for pre-indictment delay. Mr. Morris, Mr. Rauschbaum, whoever is arguing this on behalf of the state, I'll allow you to proceed at this time.
Judge, may I approach the lectern?
You may.
I got it right, lectern.
A plus for use of grammar. Go ahead, sir.
So, Judge, you've read the paper, so I'm not going to go into too much detail other than what's said. I don't want to repeat myself too much, but just to point out a couple things. Here there are two components that need to be shown. You need to show prejudice. Well, you need to show a delay, first of all. That's clear. I think that's clear on the facts. Murder was in 2014. Donna Adelson was a suspect in 2016. An affidavit was released in 2016 showing she was a suspect. You'll see the evidence in this case. We've had an opportunity to review the exhibits the state intends to present is the exact same, pretty much, evidence that existed in 2016, that existed in 2019 in the trial of the first trial of Catherine McBanua and the others. So you do have a time delay. What we have to show is prejudice. So
before you continue as to that, and really all the details as to this matter, specifically, when are you alleging the first time is Ms. Adelson could have been charged?
She could have been charged in any time. She could have been charged in 2016, right? She could have been charged. They had affidavits for arrests of certain individuals that they didn't do in 2016. So she could have been charged in the first indictment of Catherine Magbanua, Sigfredo Garcia, and Luis Rivera. She could have been charged at any point in time from there on forward.
The reason I ask the question is because the motion makes reference to 9 years, but ultimately, when someone can be charged is when the clock starts ticking, at least by the logic of your motion, correct?
I mean, yeah. Look, she could have been charged any time after 2014, right? I don't know.
I wouldn't go that far.
I'm just saying, this is not, and to be clear, this is not a statute of limitation. There is no statute of limitation.
There is none.
So we agree with that. But she could have been charged any time after the murder. But what's clear is that the evidence that they're using today, they had in 2016, right? Much of the trial in 2019, 2022, and 2023 is the exact trial that we're going to hear in 2024. So the only new evidence since then is her trying to get on an airplane to go to Vietnam, which we don't think is evidence, right? So essentially, their trial is based on wires that existed in 2016, emails that they had in 2016, text messages that they had in 2016, right? And they certainly had it in 2019. So 9 years is 9 years from, I guess, the murder, right? But if you're looking at it in any component, you're looking at what would fit under Florida law, under the 11th Circuit law, certainly a time delay, okay? So when you get that, then you have to look at the prejudice component, and you have to look first at the prejudice component. And you see here that because of that time delay, there are records that no longer exist that would show that she needs to defend herself against two of their main components of their case. So two of their main components of their case are going to be, and they're both brought in by Sergeant Corbett. Two of their main components of their case are call patterns, and I use the word patterns lightly, Because in order to show a pattern, you need a length of time to show a pattern. So when they got call records, they got call records, I believe, starting in May of 2014 through July of 2014. So they got a very short period of time. Because she wasn't charged in a timely fashion, call records showing that there is no pattern, that this is exactly what would have happened earlier, these pattern calls, existed back then, but they haven't existed for years.
What was the retention policy for the phone service provider?
I believe it was 3.5 to 4 years. So that would take you back to 2019. Give or take. And so we're able to not fully defend that point because the records don't exist anymore. That's prejudice. The second component are some text messages. So they have text messages where they claim it shows that she is outside of Charlie Adelson's house. We have to defend that. It's their one main piece of evidence. This is a premeditated crime they're charged with. Is there one piece of evidence after the murder? There's very little piece of evidence after the murder other than that and the wires. So the way to defend that is through SunPass records. Those SunPass records don't exist anymore. Now,
what is the record retention on the Sun, Bill?
3.5 years is what we're told. And that's what Agent Corbett testified to at the last trial. So, Judge, it's a predicament for us, right? Because understand that it is clear that, by the way, before 2016, just a month after the murder, the state pulled financial records for Mrs. Adelson. Pulled all of her financial records. They pulled SunPass records for other suspects in the case. They pulled call records for other people in the case. They didn't do so for Mrs. Adelson, and now those records no longer exist to defend ourselves. Now, the second component is a bad faith component. I think the prejudice component is clearly established here. The bad faith component, it's important to know that under bad faith, you do not need to show a sinister motive. The law in this court is clear. Right, United States v. Foxman, 87 F3rd at 1223, says that bad faith in this context does not require a subjective, sinister motive on the part of the prosecution. That's important. Okay, we don't have to show that the prosecution did this on purpose. What we have to show is that they had a strategy, and their strategy was to wait. That was their strategy. Their strategy was to wait because they hoped that people would flip. And they kept on hoping that people would flip. They kept on hoping through the offers of immunity and otherwise that people would flip. And over time, they didn't flip. And so they waited, they waited, they waited. And because of that, we're put in a position where these records no longer exist. Now, Judge, we do argue in the alternative in this motion. And what we argue is if the court is not willing to dismiss the case, they should keep out arguments of and admission of these pieces of evidence. Now, we're not arguing that they necessarily need to keep out all call records, but they should not be able to argue that there's a pattern of calls. Because they can't establish a pattern because there's an earlier period of time that they have no idea what exists, and we don't have the ability to show it. With regards to the text message, we think it should be excluded. The SunPass records would clearly show whether Mrs. Adelson was at the house or not at the house. It would definitively
show. Do they know?
Well, let me tell you why. Because you would see what SunPass records show back then, as they did now, is they show entry onto a turnpike.
Correct.
And so you would be able to see when she entered the turnpike.
Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
Are there not methods to travel and avoid the turnpike points?
But
where it might not be as direct, it might not be as easy, where if you enter the turnpike here, you have an easier point of access to drive. But ultimately, Could she have reached Mr. Adelson's home and avoided the Sun Pass altogether?
Their records show she did enter the turnpike. Their own witness shows that she entered the turnpike because he's got, on his many charts where he guesses, he's got her on the turnpike through a cell tower. So you don't have to guess that she entered the turnpike. You know exactly that she did enter the turnpike. Their own records show that she entered the turnpike at what's called the Dolphin Expressway. Okay? So you go take 95, and you get on the turnpike at the Dolphin Expressway. That's where Dolphin Stadium is. You would, first of all, see on the Sun Pass the entrance there. And their records show that she's on that. Their cell tower records show that. Okay? Their cell tower records show also time frames on that same turnpike. Shows on their map, on their dots. They show her on the turnpike. What it can't show is if she got off the turnpike, it may not have shown her get off the turnpike, but it would have shown her get back on. So in other words, if they're correct, and she had gone to Charlie Adelson's house, which she didn't, but if they're correct, at some point she would have had to exit the turnpike. Okay? It wouldn't have shown her exiting the turnpike because when you exit the turnpike, it doesn't show you exiting. But they have her at a certain point in time back on the turnpike. They would have known when she got back on the turnpike and where. And that would have showed whether she was at his house or not. Definitively, it would have shown it. We wouldn't have to guess about it. It's just how the Sun Pass records work. It shows when you enter, and then it shows parts at the turnpike. So they're using a witness to make guesses. They have these beautiful charts where they have her pinpoint, and then they have Charlie Adelson's house, and they show that it could take from this time to this time, extra time. But they have no idea when she got off, where she got off, why she got off. And they would know for certain, 100%, we would be able to show for certain, 100%, if we had those records, whether she was at his house or not.
Excluding for one moment a future argument about Sergeant Corbett, why are these not right topics for cross-examination?
Judge, clearly if they're allowed in, they're right topics for cross-examination, but you have to do a balancing test. This is the premier piece of evidence in this case. It is the number one piece of evidence in this case outside your house, because it is the only piece of evidence in this case other than the wires that ties Mrs. Adelson to anything after the murder. It is the only piece of evidence. We have the wires speak for themselves. We have the checks that she wrote. We're not going to argue that she didn't write the checks. This is the only piece of evidence. And they're using conjecture to get it in where if they had charged this case in a timely fashion, we would be able to show definitively she wasn't there. That's not our fault.
All right, let's go back to the U.S. Supreme Court case that is the genesis of this argument, Wasco. I believe Justice Marshall goes through the role of the prosecutor and their duties and also discusses how the prosecutor has an affirmative duty not to charge someone before they have probable cause to thoroughly investigate the case, and also not to clog the court system with cases they cannot prove. What is your response ultimately to this discussion as it relates to this case?
I think it's a very fair question. I think what you have to do is you have to then look at what has changed. So in other words, in doing that, that can't always be their answer. Right? They can't just have a blanket answer. They have to be held accountable as to, okay, what has changed? Right? And the reality is when you look at this case and you see what is going to be presented, you have the exhibit list. When you look at the exhibit list for this case and you compare it to the exhibit list in 2019, it is essentially the same exhibit list. 2019, the first trial. I'm not even talking about Charlie Adelson's trial. It is essentially the same exact exhibit list. Their exhibit list contains, essentially, against Mrs. Adelson, emails that they had back then, wires that they had back then, checks that they had back then. That's essentially their case against her. Okay? So the reality is, when you're right. They should not charge people that they don't have probable cause for. But that can't always be their answer. They have to be held to ask, well, what has changed? You know, we asked a similar question in the last trial, and their answer was dolce vita. Okay, but dolce vita doesn't apply to Mrs. Adelson. She wasn't there, right? Everything that they had in 2000, and by the way, they had dolce vita, they just didn't have a clear version of it. The reality is, you're going to see that 95%, probably more, of this case that we're about to hear is the same exact case as it was in 2019. Almost the same witnesses. Almost the same evidence. It's the same case.
Any further argument?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Dugan and Ms. Kaplan.
Thank you, Judge. So as the defense's motion states, the test here for is going to be whether substantial prejudice is caused, not just prejudice, to the defendant's right to a fair trial, and was it the product of bad faith so that dismissal is required. The two pieces of evidence that they talk about in their motion are the phone records and the SunPass, so I wanted to quickly go through each. For phone records, he says, well, you know, there are call patterns between the parties that occur on major events during the planning of this murder that the state presents. But every time we present this evidence, we also concede and present the fact that the people in this case, they all have relationships outside of any planning for this murder. Their boyfriend, girlfriend, their parent, child, they have children together. Those people in those relationships talk every day. That's normal and that's to be expected. And all these people do talk every day during the time that we have these phone records. Every time we've tried this case, the defense picks a random day. This is every trial we've had since 2019, I guess. Every defense attorney, you know, picks a random day that summer and shows that, hey, there's also calls between these folks on these other days that where there's not a trip to Tallahassee or some other big event in the planning of this murder to show exactly that. They've done that every time through cross-examination, and they do that without having prior records prior to May of 2014. So there's no substantial prejudice to the defendant. And there's no bad faith here. Law enforcement subbed records beginning in May of 2014 because they were trying to get records from around the time the shooting occurred in July of 2014, so a little bit before. And then also we have records after. We have records leading up to 2016 where there was no murder being planned at that time. And obviously all of the parties in this case, as we established in the case, are still in contact. They're still talking because they all have those pre-existing relationships.
Before you continue, is there a reason the records that are at issue in this motion were never pursued?
Because those are the times around the June and July trips where there was the attempt to kill and the murder of Dan Markell. We have messages between them going back before that time, but we believed, or law enforcement believed at the time that they subpoenaed the records, that that was the most relevant time to the information in this case that would be relevant to this case.
Were any further subpoenas as to SunPass or phone followed up on once the state believed it did have probable cause against Mrs. Adelson?
I believe that after, well, so getting to the SunPass records, the SunPass records, we did, I think, try to get late last year once it came to light that, can I address the SunPass records and I'll let you know kind of what our intent was? Okay. All right, going back to the phone records, though, this is not substantial prejudice, and it's not a situation, though, where the state purposefully did not indict Ms. Adelson until she could not get these phone records anymore. So there's no bad faith in this case. It's not a situation where we purposely didn't indict her so she couldn't get that. Moving on to the SunPass records, first of all, there's no substantial prejudice that these records would be exculpatory. You know, as the court pointed out, we don't know if there was a way she could have avoided that. We don't know if the exit or entrance even had a transponder in 2014. In fact, you know, given that the defendant texted Charlie Adelson outside your house, and there was a witness at trial, Catherine Ray Banois, who said that the defendant had been at the house that night right before she arrived. We believe the Sun Path records could very well be inculpatory. And there's no bad faith here because we would actually like the Sun Path records too. We did, as the court asked, we had Jason Newland make a call to try to see if we could get the Sun Path records. I believe it was last fall in 2023, but we also learned that they don't have them anymore this far late in the game. But the bad faith portion of this is only satisfied when the government makes a judgment about how to proceed with litigation to gain advantage over the defendant, and as a result, the indictment is delayed. The reason we didn't try to get the Sun Path records earlier was because the state didn't really zero in on the fact that Donna Adelson went to Charlie Adelson's house the night of the murder until Catherine Rambanilla offered that information in 2023, leading up to Charlie's trial and at Charlie Adelson's trial. Catherine Rambanilla mentioned that Donna and Harvey Adelson had visited Charlie Adelson's house the night of the murder.
Before you continue,
yes,
was this new information learned either through the proffer or trial preparation that had never been or never come to light before?
Yes, we learned that from her through her proffer and through information that she gave leading up to trial and her testimony at trial, which was all in 2023, the trial being Charlie Adelson's trial in the fall of 2023. Obviously, Donna Adelson's phone locations, right, have always been in the records. The messages have always been in the records, but we didn't zero in on the fact that, hey, that's where this cash could have came from, and that was this relevant to the money drop, until Catherine Rambanois said his parents had just been there right before I arrived. She said in her testimony that the money was there when she arrived, that it was damp. She believed Donna Adelson had washed the money. That made us zero in on the fact that Donna Adelson had been at Charlie Adelson's house right before she arrived, and that's when this money exchange could have taken place. After that, we began to look for evidence, that corroborated her statements. Leading up to trial, and we found evidence in the phone records that corroborates the fact that Donna Adelson did go by the house through her locations, through the message outside your house. But this wasn't a situation where we waited to indict Donna Adelson until Sun Path records were no longer available. We would like to have those too. The Foxman case says that the defense says that this delay had to have been a deliberate act to gain a tactical advantage, and that's not what we have here. I'd also point out Dan Rashbaum has said that he was retained in this case by Donna Adelson in 2016. Every trial that we've ever had has been on YouTube, if anybody wants to see it, and they could have, if they believe that these Sun Path records and phone records were so exonerating and obviously needed, those could have been requested prior to when they would no longer have been able to have been received.
Can the defendant, absent an active case and a subpoena of this nature?
The defense said in the last trial that he tried to get the Sun Path records, and he wasn't able to before we had even thought to try to get them.
Please continue.
I'm not sure when he tried to do that. Another thing here is that if the court denies this motion, I think at that time it would become ripe. The state would ask that the defense not be able to argue in opening or closings or testify in their own questions that, hey, because the defendant wasn't indicted until 2023, that means law enforcement or the state attorney's office didn't believe they had enough evidence. What anyone in law enforcement or state attorney's office thinks in this case is not relevant. Given that, we believe that, obviously the dates that law enforcement received evidence, the dates that, suspects were tried or convicted, those things are all fair game and can be pointed out by the defense. But not the argument that this delay was because the state attorney's office or law enforcement didn't believe there was enough evidence to convict.
So to summarize in a nutshell, the state did not even understand what it had in the way of the text message until Catherine McBanilla's proffer.
That Catherine McBanilla's information that she provided to the state really made us zero in on that and realized that money could have been exchanged at that time by Donna Adelson to Charlie Adelson. Well, obviously, we always knew that they were traveling up to Tallahassee that night, the Harvey and Donna Adelson were.
After the murder took place.
Yes, sir. But Catherine McManus's information that we learned after her trial and she began to cooperate in leading up to Charlie Adelson's trial is what made us zero in on that.
Very well. Thank you. Brief response, and then we're going to move on to the other motions.
Sure. Judge, I'll do the factual point first. I was retained to represent Donna Adelson in the late summer of 2016. Okay, so I think it was the end of July, beginning of August 2016, I was retained to represent Donna Adelson. The first trial happened in 2019. When that trial happened, we tried to get SunPass records. We did. We couldn't, because we weren't an active party. We didn't have any subpoena power.
Were you stonewalled by SunPass?
They told us, yeah, exactly. Okay. When we tried to get SunPass records again was when Charles Adelson was indicted in the case. Then we were able to subpoena and try to get SunPass records. We were unable to do so because they didn't exist. So let me be clear on that. Okay? All right. The first time we were able to attempt to get SunPass records, they no longer existed. Okay? Now, with regards to them, she makes a point that every counsel has picked a prior date. Let me tell you what happens. We did pick a prior date, but our universe for picking a prior date is like this big, right? And you'll recall at the last trial what happened with the prior date we picked, right? We aren't making prior dates. They found a court filing on that prior date. By the way, the court filing wasn't anywhere near the time of the calls, but they found a court filing on that prior date, and they made a big showing that this is another event, right? The reality is we want to find dates in 2013, in 2012, in January of 2014, in February of 2014. None of those existed because what they did is they got records only for a four-month period of time. And any date that we picked...
As to that point, yeah. And I understand what you're getting at, but don't defense counsel in all manner of cases all the time say the subpoena was too wide? You cast too far. Meaning, the murder, what led before, what led after, there's really not a lot of argument as to the relevance. But if the state is seeking records of your client, or hypothetically any defendant, going back years in advance, are they really permitted to do that?
They don't need to go back years in advance, but they're presenting evidence in this case. Let me make 2 points to that. First of all, they got financial records years in advance. So if they got financial records years in advance, why didn't they get the same cell phone records years in advance? What's good for the goose is good for the gander. If he thought it was good enough to get financial records that far back, get the cell records that far back, number one. Number two, they're putting emails in this case back from 2012. Why not go at least back to 2012 or at least back to 2013? They just cherry-picked a four-month period. And by the way, the records she talks about in that come on later, they're related to the bump. They're not related to anything else. They're related to the bump. So yeah, they created an activity. And of course, that's going to create another pattern, a pattern, right? The reality is it's unfair because they're making a pattern argument that doesn't, if it was a science experiment, it'd be a false experiment. Their sample size is too small. And we can't counter it because the records don't exist. And we don't need to show that they did it on, we don't need to show that they indicted her after the records existed. We're not claiming that that's what they did. They made other strategic decisions to delay her indictment. And those other strategic decisions had this consequence. And because of that, if you don't dismiss the indictment, you should not allow these records to come into evidence.
Do you have any response to the effect of the proffer as it relates to the messages?
Of course.
Ms. McDowell's proffer, which was taken last year.
Of course. They had the message well before then. They had the outside your house message well before then. It's not... Listen, when I saw it in discovery, which was before the proffer, I knew exactly what they were going to argue. It's very clear. You didn't need her crazy argument to know what they were going to argue.
Well, let's look at this from the aspect of bad faith. Is it possible in a voluminous case file to not know what this one piece of paper actually means until a later date?
It is possible, but you have three prosecutors in this case, very fine prosecutors who have tried this case going into that case two times. So very unlikely. Very, very unlikely. That's what I would say. Possible? Yeah, anything's possible. But it's not that hard of a message to figure out. You have one of the key suspects in the case who you've gotten other records for, communicating with another key suspect in the case, who, by the way, in 2019, their theory was the same, that it was a murder for hire done by these two individuals. You have those key, and you don't have many text messages between the two. And you have one, and by the way, you only have like three text messages on the day of the murder. And so it's pretty hard to imagine that they didn't think a text message from mom to son on the day of the murder, on the night when you're driving up, outside your house, 10 minutes, is the response, was not an important text message. I mean, if you believe that, I don't know, Judge. That seems a little, I'm skeptical of that.
Did they have the benefit, though, of the proffer until Ms. McBanawah gave it?
They didn't have the benefit of the proffer, but you should listen to that proffer, because she doesn't talk about the outside the house message. And by the way, in that proffer, she doesn't even really talk about what they say she talks about. She did it on the stand, but she didn't do it in the proffer. That's not my memory of the proffer. She didn't say in the proffer that I don't believe that they had just left the house. That's what she said on the stand. They'd already put in the outside they'd already marked that as an exhibit. So, Judge, again, the standard is lower than what they're saying. Right. It's a bad faith standard, but it doesn't need to show that they purposely waited until after the Sun Pass records didn't exist anymore. We're not alleging that. We don't think that that's what they did. We think they made other choices that then made it. Look, at the end of the day, Judge, what it also is you get to do a balancing test. And it's a fairness argument. But aside from everything else, it's a fairness argument.
It's clear Velasco is rooted in due process.
Yeah, it's a fairness argument.
I'm going to reserve ruling as to this. Also, prior to making any ruling, I'm going to review the trial testimony of Ms. McBanawan concerning the outside your house text message, as I believe it does give context to what is being argued in the motion by both parties. Right, let's move on to the defendant's motion to hold trial in courtroom 3B. Mr. Morris.
Thank you, Judge. We've had a little bit of discussion about this previously. There are a couple of practical reasons. You're going to be the best judge of what occurred during Charlie Adelson's trial and the interactions with jury and gallery. Essentially, this motion seeks a prophylactic measure against that. You're great at controlling your courtroom and being able to interact with the audience in the gallery.
But you still want a different courtroom. Don't butter me up. Get to the point.
Fair enough. Judge, where we sit at counsel table there, the prosecutor's table obstructs the view of jurors 1, 2, 8, and 9. There's no ability for Ms. Adelson to view those jurors. There's no ability for the jurors to view Ms. Adelson or defense counsel. And, of course, that's an important facet. Defense counsel sits here. The display is here. Examining a witness, you park at the prosecutor's table, of course. Disconcertingly, in the last case, there were circumstances where communications between counsel and the defendant are posted on the internet before the lawyer can even get back to their hotel. And so it's been interesting to read the media response. This isn't a circumstance of trying to curtail the media's ability to gain access. It's a function of trying to facilitate there are fewer opportunities for problems to arise. you know, it's a practical consideration, and of course, all of this is in your discretion.
Well, I was going to say, in researching your motion, I did not come across a fundamental statutory or procedural right to be tried in a particular courtroom. Do you have one to argue today?
No, I do not. It's a due process argument and an argument of prophylactic measures to protect against. And then the last component, which I've tried many cases in the courtroom, multi-codefendant cases in the courtroom. All of them are different. The acoustics in this room are rough sometimes. But from the number of inmates that we potentially have testifying in the case and the movements of people,
yes.
It's not my challenge, it's the bailiff's challenge, there are security issues, and I know that it's difficult here. Courtroom 3B is smaller and more compact. I know that there's, someone has mentioned that there are technological concerns of it being antiquated. No better time for us to ask court admin for an upgrade. We've got time to be able to put a machine in that works appropriately. There's really a functionality and a practicality argument to make sure that we best protect Ms. Adelson against from things that we've seen occur previously.
Very well. What you raise about counsel table, when we do have co-defendant trials in this room, a second table is added. It is the defense's preference to ultimately have what would be considered as the co-defendant's table and face the jury for the duration of the trial.
I think we're, irrespective of which courtroom, I think that we would need a second table anyways. We have one additional person sitting at counsel table with us during the trial, so there would be four. So we'd have the traditional L, if you will, from whether it be in 3B or here. It's a little bit more difficult here because of the configuration to be able to put that many people, but to answer your question, yes, we'd like to be facing the jury, but in 3B, I guess.
Very well. Response from the state as to this motion.
Yes, sir. Yesterday, a letter was sent by the Markell family stating their reasons they wanted to remain in 3G. Did the court receive that?
I was able to review it. There were also some other letters that I received, either from concerned parties that were forwarded, I believe the state and defense as well. Did everyone receive the letters of the concerned parties?
Yes, sir.
You may continue.
Aside from those letters, just from the prosecution's perspective, the primary reason for us asking that it remain in 3G is just from a practicality standpoint in presenting the case. You know, in 3G, we have the big screen overhead. We have the multiple screens in the jury box for the individual jurors. We have a screen, an individual screen for the witness. In 3B, there's only one overhead screen that all 12 jurors will have to kind of squint to see. Also in 3B, the clarity of the picture on that overhead projector that from the big screen, and sometimes the sensitivity of the USB cord that's connected to your computer are a concern. Sometimes the state has to actually, you know, wheel a TV down for in that courtroom to use.
Don't bring up that
very
television.
Very inefficient, and I know it's
important. You know I hate that television.
Right, it's a pain. And so, you know, being in 3G isn't just something that we do for, or we've asked for. In this case, we ask for it in all cases where we have a lot of visual evidence to be shown. In this case, we have surveillance video, cell phone records, maps, texts, emails, financial records with graphs and charts and electronic wire transcripts and other visual demonstratives that I think will be much easier for the jury to see and understand if the trial is in 3G. In the defense motion, they bring up, you know, the inability to see the box that the judge has already, or as the court's already addressed. They also bring up the lectern placement as an optimal. I routinely will move the lectern with the microphone over to the projector so that I can operate the projector, or have my laptop up here on the lectern so that I can use my laptop and have it on the big screen so that I'm still at the lectern and not and can move it about. And I think that that should solve their problem, the ability to move this lectern around. Finally, I just want to point out that, you know, the defense is concerned about juror distraction. However, in 3B, the jury box is extremely close to the gallery. So if there, I think that there's a risk for distraction there as well.
And I think that the court in the last trial, through instructions to the jury and through, you know, making sure there was no cell phones used, was able to remedy that.
Very well. I prepared a rule on this issue today. I believe as the final jury instructions make clear, the jury will be instructed that they are to decide this matter based on the nature and quality of the evidence presented. The court is going to take all means necessary to avoid there being any distractions from persons present, sitting in the gallery, or attempting to improperly influence the jury in some manner. The examples that were cited by the defense, the court is not taking lightly. At the same time, the court does not have a way to ultimately prevent what is being complained of in the motion from happening in any courtroom. I am going to be very diligent and also very thorough in the deployment of the bailiffs as it results in this matter. The court also will take all suggestion from the defense as it relates to the placement of the table so the defendant can be clearly seen by the jurors throughout the trial. As to the placement of seating on the defense side, ultimately, any observers or onlookers in the gallery are going to be placed at least two or three pews behind the defense, so that way there can be no attempts to either photograph or record the defense's interactions with each other, with Mrs. Adelson, or attempt to get any snippets of papers or other matters. Concerning the media and also any onlookers, I'm really not going to get into why people wish to come, if they have a legitimate interest, or if it's just a curiosity for them. The Constitution provides that the courtroom will be open. Unless there is a statutory or otherwise basis for closing the courtroom or excluding persons, the courtroom is considered open. However, the conduct of those persons, the court will closely monitor. Anyone who is acting inappropriately will be removed from the trial. If this even goes to the issue of contempt and trying to influence the jury in an improper way, believe me, I have no problem having them break out the handcuffs. You can ask around. The defendant's motion to move the trial to courtroom 3B is denied. And this is also for practical purposes as well. Courtroom 3G is the most recently renovated courtroom in the Leon County Courthouse. It has technology options that are unavailable in the other courtrooms, and it is also best capable of accommodating the needs of this trial itself. If the state can prepare an order or the defense as to the denial, let's move on to the defendant's motion to suppress wiretap interceptions.
Judge, I'm definitely not going to belabor this motion. It is the same exact motion that was filed in the last trial. It was denied in the last trial. The only difference in this motion is we have a section where it shows that Ms. Adelson has standing to make this motion. So, Judge, I'm just going to rest on the papers. It's a preservation motion. We respect your judge's ruling previously, and I don't think, unless you want me to answer any questions.
I don't believe the state is contesting the standing of the defendant to raise this issue, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Does the state have any additional argument to make concerning this?
Judge, I do have a couple things I think I should put on the record so we're not relying on your previous ruling in this case.
Go ahead. Well, as to certain findings or conclusions of law as to my review of Judge Hankinson's authorization, those to a certain extent I will be relying on, but I'll allow you to continue to make your argument.
Yes, sir. I just want to put a couple things on the record regarding the standard for, it's alleged in the motion that necessity is a standard, and truly that's not the case pursuant to Phillips v. State 346 Southern 3rd 1252 exhaustion and the objective of the criminal investigation are the standard. And in this case, we have met that standard by showing that other investigative efforts have, you know, tried and failed or are too dangerous, or that this wiretap in this case was the most reasonable investigative technique under the circumstances. Regarding the objectives of the conspiracy in this case, the objectives of the wire in this case, it was to reveal the identity of the conspirators and their role in the conspiracy, so the structure of the conspiracy, and that's permissible under McGuire v. State 307 Federal 3rd 1192, that's a 2002 case. So here, again, we're trying to identify the persons involved and gather sufficient reliable evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt what their roles are, what's the hierarchy of the conspiracy, is there any additional physical evidence that can be gleaned in this case, any information regarding monies or assets or other things of value. Regarding the staleness issue that's raised in the motion, I did want to point out a couple things. We note that the issue of staleness cannot be solved by a simple application of numbers of days without consideration for the overall particular circumstances presented in this case. Here, the circumstances of this investigation required efforts that involved a lot of record gathering and waiting for records and receiving records and analyzing them before we got to the point where we had reached exhaustion and were looking to seek a wiretap. The state's subpoena served on 12-14 of 15, requested a bunch of records between 14 and 15. Those were received in 16, including this defendant's checking account. We then subpoenaed a bunch of different Adelson accounts, that including the one that the checks came from, and those were not received until 3-1 of 16. So, you know, that accounts for the timing. And there's a case that talks about, did I get it for you? Delay being appropriate in conspiracy cases, or more leeway being given in conspiracy cases, because of the nature of the investigation, it's going to take more time. And I think that is...
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.